This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Who else has been jamming out to Tupac in the last, couple of weeks? More than they have. I can't say it's ever really left my playlist since 1996, but I have to say it's increased in rotation in the last little bit. And I'm like, damn, I miss some of this stuff. Some of this stuff was good. All Eyes on Me, that's a great album. Anyway, the trial, 30 years after the death of Tupac Shakur. That's what we're talking about today and where it is at with our daily update for you. Press subscribe wherever you get podcasts so you don't miss it. We're walking you through the whole trial, breaking it down, and you can stay up to date. And if you're not going to watch every moment of coverage, I don't blame you. There's a lot to get through, and there's a lot of trials going on right now. By the way, take our podcast with you. The QR code is right there on the screen if you're watching us on YouTube. If you're not, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi wherever you get podcasts, if you're not already doing that, and press subscribe so you don't miss any of our conversations on this case. September 9th, 2009, a Las Vegas detective, an LAPD detective, and Dwayne Davis, with his own lawyer beside him. The detective wants to know what went through his head once Tupac Shakur was dead. This is interesting. We're getting some interesting little nuggets out of this trial, especially if this is a case that you followed since 1996, like I have. His answer on tape: I knew. We was like, damn, we can get paid now. One detective checks it. Paid by Puffy, right? Davis. Yeah. That tape played for a Las Vegas jury on Friday, August 21st of 2026. Sean Combs has denied any involvement in the killing for 30 years, by the way. We're not saying he's involved. I'm just telling you what happened in court. Police have never named him a suspect, and he's never been charged. Everything Davis says about him is Davis's claim, and the jury heard it come out of Davis's own mouth. Davis, by the way, is the one on trial here for murder. So does it benefit him to say Puffy was involved? Minimally, maybe? I mean, or not? I mean, it. I don't think it does. I don't think that helps either. No, because that just shows he did it for money. If that's true. Or, I guess here's how it could benefit. If it can be really shown that Puffy had nothing to do with it, and this is another lie, and he's a liar, so the Puffy story's a lie, why would this other story be true? Reasonable doubt is the game here, so they're going to try and find it wherever they can. By the end of that day, the jury had heard Davis tell this story three ways: to detectives for a deal, to a camera for a check, and then on his feet in a courtroom where no one was paying. Davis is the only person ever charged in Tupac's murder. Prosecutors don't say he fired. They say he planned the attack and supplied the gun. That's the charge he's fighting. And Friday belonged almost entirely to his own voice. The first witness of the day was the man in the story who never told his version. Leonard Jefferson came to the Las Vegas in 1996 for the Tyson fight and never went in. He sold his tickets in a hotel lobby and spent the night people watching. Later, at a stoplight, he raised a camera and took a picture of Tupac in the passenger seat of a black BMW with Suge Knight driving. It is the last photo of Tupac alive. You probably are picturing it in your head right now. Minutes later, Jefferson testified that police drew their guns at him at the scene, ordered him out of his car, then let him go. He went back to his hotel. An officer tracked him down there and told him to come back. The reason, by Jefferson's account, they'd messed up by releasing him. A juror asked which detective met him when he returned. Kevin Manning. Jefferson didn't know what he had until he developed the role weeks later. The photo became famous, and so did a theory that he'd staged it. Prosecutors asked him directly. I did not. The man who never changed his story and never got paid for it had to be fetched by the police that lost him. 30 years on, the state still needs him to say that the picture is real. Then came the version with a price tag. Mario Diaz directed Death Row Chronicles, a six-part BET series from 2018. He testified that Davis was paid to appear. Davis himself had said publicly he did the show for the money. Diaz testified he handed Davis at least one paycheck. He put the total somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000, and on cross allowed it might have come in $5,000 installments. Davis shook his head in the courtroom while he said it. That's all you get for being in the Death Row Chronicles? That's all you get for, like, going on camera and admitting you were part of a murder? That's... end up with, like, 10, 15 grand at the end of the day? For putting that out there? That seems like a... I don't think that's a... That is a decision that is motivated by money. That is a decision that is motivated by ego. Yes, $10,000, $15,000. It's a nice little chunk of change. Not enough to publicly, expressly admit to murder. unless you really think you're going to get away with it, which it seems to be a bit of a gamble that he was doing. I mean, just take the idea of being busted by the police out of it for a moment. Take the idea that you're openly admitting on television that you had direct involvement with the murder of Tupac. You might get a hit put out on you. There might be some people that don't like that. To me, it just seems like, oh, but remember, Keefe thought he was dying of cancer at the moment, wanted to get that check, although it wasn't that much. And he's egotistical as shit. That's a good recipe for stupidity. Which, if you ask me, the man has pretty much lived that path through all of his existence. Maybe it's time for the cancer to win. The jury watched the clips, Davis on camera, saying, I'm coming out now to tell the story because I got cancer. I got nothing else to lose. He said he saw Tupac in the BMW working the crowd like he was in a parade, and his car made a U-turn to catch up. Davis then said, I'm the only one alive who can tell you who really killed Tupac. Asked who fired, he told the producer, keep it for the code of the streets. It just came from the backseat, bro. A 2008 statement started as someone else's case. An LAPD task force was investigating the killing of the notorious B.I.G. And Dupree testified earlier in the week that federal prosecutors were holding drug charges over Davis to bring him to the table. The deal was a proffer. He talks, and nothing he says in that room can be used to charge him. Dupree also testified the task force never asked Davis about Tupac. At a meeting before the proffer, they asked about the Wallace killing, and Davis denied it, then added, we did the other one. Dupree from the stand, we were shook. We were surprised. They weren't even asking him about Tupac, and he volunteered it. Oh, this is a man who's just done stupid shit his entire life. The jury has heard the promise in Greg Kading's own voice. Nothing you say today can be used against you. Another voice in the recording. Nothing leaves this room. Then Dupree's warning. If you don't say nothing, it's cool. But if you go out there and start talking. Diaz testified that audio from that sealed interview ended up in his hands for the show. He cut pieces into the episode. He told the jury he got it from one of two consultants on the series, Kading or Mike Dorsey. Kading is the detective who made the promise on the tape, and after retiring, he described that interview in a book he published in 2011. Dorsey is his co-author. Diaz couldn't remember which man actually handed it over. Mike Dorsey took the stand later that afternoon. He testified he wrote that, questions Diaz asked Davis and fed him follow-ups as the interview went on. He recorded the session on his own phone. Dorsey's own film about the case, Murder Rap, drew a letter from Combs' lawyers to Apple TV calling it defamatory. Dorsey said no lawsuit ever actually came, though. On cross, the defense put the book Kading and Dorsey wrote about the investigation on the screen. Diaz admitted he'd read it. A juror asked how the description was made to splice police audio into a television episode. Diaz, the decision was mine. Prosecutors told the jury the BET series and the memoir Davis published a year later are what stripped the protection off his 2008 statement. He went out there and started talking. The judge agreed before trial that this ruling is the only reason the jury has heard a word of it. By Dupree's account, the task force had even signed Davis up as a confidential informant in March of 2009. By his account, on that September 2009 recording, the hunt started at Club 662. They were looking for the men who'd beaten his nephew, Orlando Anderson, in the MGM lobby hours earlier. Suge Knight specifically. Suge's car was not there. They left and stopped at a liquor store. Detectives asked if they'd search for Tupac's crew. Davis, nah, we got lucky. Then the white Cadillac pulled up beside a black BMW. Davis says a man he calls Zip pulled a 40 Glock from a secret compartment in the car and told him, handle your business. Davis says he handed it to DeAndre Smith in the back seat and that Orlando asked for it. A detective asked what happened next. Davis said, got to shooting. The detective pushed him on who, and Davis gave the name Orlando. Davis says Orlando shot at Suge 5 or 6 times. He says he saw a bullet hit Suge's head and thought Suge was the only one hit. Asked where Orlando was aiming, Davis said he didn't know. Afterward, he says, Orlando urinated on his hands to wash off the gunpowder. The jury heard one more thing happen in that room. Shortly after Davis described the gun, he asked the Las Vegas detective to leave. Dupree stayed, so did Davis's lawyer at the time, Wayne Higgins. Davis went on describing a Las Vegas murder with the Las Vegas detective outside the door. So the state's exhibit carries the state's theory, the beating, the hunt, the gun Davis says he passed. It also carries, we got lucky. The sentence the defense will want the jury to remember, both are on the same recording. The detective circled back to Combs before they were done. Did he play a role in the shooting? Davis, yeah, I think so. Davis had described in that room expecting to be paid after Tupac died. But by his own account, the money never came. Combs denies all of it, has never been charged, and is in New York, in jail, on his own charges. How did Davis feel about Tupac being dead? I wish it never happened, man. And then the line the jury heard last, I wish I never met Puff Daddy, period. He messed up my life. The man who said he expected a payday for a murder was describing himself as the one who got hurt. In this case, financially. Friday afternoon, after hours of his own voice, Davis stood up in the courtroom. He pointed at the prosecutor, said, I get beat up by the cops. The guy attacked me in here, sent me to prison. This is just wrong, and it's mostly this guy. Prosecutor answered, for the record, I think he's indicating he's upset I'm prosecuting him for murder. Earlier in the day, outside the jury's presence, David had complained that the state keeps putting his address and his sister's address in public filings. He said his house had been broken into. The judge said she was aware. Court resumes this week. The tape keeps playing. Orlando Anderson has been dead since 1998. The detective who took the confession became an author and a consultant, and the filmmaker got his series. The only man in the story who says he never got paid is the one on trial. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation right there. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
The jury heard a recording in it. Dwayne Keefe D. Davis described the night Tupac Shakur was shot. He blamed his nephew, Orlando Baby Lane Anderson, as the gunman. He described providing the weapon. He even discussed Sean Puffy Combs and money. He explained how Combs allegedly wanted Suge Knight taken care of. He talked about the brawl at the MGM Grand and the retaliation that followed. Then, near the end of the recording, the interviewer, Mario Diaz, the executive producer of Death Row Chronicles, asked Davis a question. You want to apologize to Tupac's family? Davis said, no. I didn't do nothing, he told Diaz. I didn't do nothing to his family. Now, that whole, you know, providing the gun to your nephew and rolling up alongside Tupac and saying, you know, do your business. That's nothing, right, Keefe? That's the moment that's mattered the most from day six of the Tupac murder trial. Not because it's a confession. The jury has already heard those. It matters because of what it does to the defense's own theory. We're going to go through the latest in the trial. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love for you to weigh in. And if you're not already, follow the podcast. Link is right there. The QR code on the screen. If you're watching us on YouTube, take us with you on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, wherever you get podcasts. Go check it out. Just take your phone, scan it. There you go. We do appreciate that. Day six opened with defense attorney Michael Snaft arguing that the recording the jury heard Friday from the 2017 production of Death Row Chronicles contained references to other crimes and should not have been played. The judge issued limiting instructions and allowed the recording to stand. That fight right there, well, that tells you a lot. Tells you where the defense is. Snaft has built his case on one argument. Everything Davis ever said about the Tupac shooting was fiction, invented to make a little bit of money. Davis has said from jail that he admitted to involvement in the killing to make money for his family. His defense team has argued that prosecutors are leaning on decades-old statements instead of actual physical evidence. The problem is the volume of those statements and the chain they created. Davis first told the story in 2008 while he was facing a potential life sentence on federal drug charges. Investigators from a joint LAPD and Las Vegas Metro Task Force brought him in under a proffer agreement. The proffer works like this. A suspect sits in his attorney's office with investigators and agrees to tell them what he knows. In exchange, investigators agree not to use what he says directly against him. Former LAPD Detective Greg Kading told Davis on the recording, played earlier in the trial, nothing you say can be used against you. Davis sat in that room in Los Angeles County and talked for hours. He described providing the gun. He told detectives he was in the front passenger seat of the white Cadillac and that Anderson fired from the back. He said he would have pulled the trigger himself if Tupac had been on his side of the car. He told the story again to Las Vegas Metro detectives in 2009. He told it to a BET documentary crew in 2017. He published a book in 2019. In between, details from the proffer leaked into Kading's 2011 book, Murder Rap. And later in the documentaries, prosecutors have argued that Davis's decision to go public stripped away the protections of the original proffer. The judge agreed, ruling both the book and the proffer interviews admissible. Every time the prosecution plays another version, the fiction defense gets a little thinner. Snaft is not trying to keep out a single damaging statement. He's trying to slow the flood, basically. The prosecution's witness for day six was a filmmaker named Michael Dorsey. Dorsey directed the 2015 documentary Murder Rap and later worked as a consultant on Death Row Chronicles. He spent years researching the Tupac and Biggie cases, access to thousands of investigative reports, roughly 100 hours of audio, photographs, and case files. Dorsey started following the case around 2012, spent over 2 years making the Murder Rap film, and helped write the questions that Diaz used to interview interviewed Davis on camera for Death Row Chronicles. During cross-examination, Snaft established Dorsey is not a detective and did not interview Las Vegas Metro detectives during his initial documentary research, even though Las Vegas had jurisdiction over the Tupac case. During the 2017 interview, Dorsey was in the room, not as the interviewer, but as a consultant. While Diaz ran the session, Dorsey hit record on his own phone. His recording captured audio before the official production recorder had restarted, making his version potentially broader than the actual professional one. When he was subpoenaed, Dorsey turned the phone recording over to prosecutors. After Death Row Chronicles aired, he contacted Las Vegas Metropolitan Police about what Davis had said. He testified that Combs' attorney sent a letter to Apple TV calling the documentary defamatory, but Dorsey was never sued. He kept forwarding Davis's subsequent public statements to investigators as Davis continued talking. The man who spent a decade chasing the Tupac murder became the link in the evidence chain. He helped produce the interview, sat in the room while it happened, and made his own recording. Then he called the cops. The recording the jury heard contained Davis's account of the events and the people involved. He discussed Combs and what Combs, Diddy, allegedly wanted. Now, again, be careful here. Combs has always denied any sort of involvement in any of this. This is a recount of what was going on in the trial. He discussed Combs and what Combs allegedly wanted. Davis said Combs wanted the big guy taken care of, referring specifically to Suge Knight, the head of Death Row Records. So if these accounts are to be believed, Sean Diddy Combs target was Suge, not necessarily Tupac. Davis called his nephew Anderson his best friend, his everything. He said they went to Vegas for the Tyson fight, not because they expected to confront Knight. After the shooting, according to the recording, Davis tried calling Combs' house multiple times. Combs wouldn't return the calls. Davis said Combs was trying to wash his hands of them. When asked whether he received money afterwards, Davis said no. The situation was hot, he said. Combs has denied any involvement in Shakur's death and has never been charged in connection with it. In the same recording, Diaz asked Davis how he felt about Tupac. Davis's answer, to me, he was an ignorant kid in the prime of his life, not remorse, not the language of a man crafting a sympathetic documentary arc. Diaz pushed further. Do you think about his family? Davis said yes. He said he hated that it had to go that way. When asked if he was concerned about revealing everything, Davis said, the Lord had him. He helped me through cancer, Davis said. He told the interviewer he had cancer, had nothing left to lose, and cared only about the truth. Then Diaz asked the question, you want to apologize to his family, to Tupac's family? No, I didn't do nothing. I didn't do nothing to his family. I guess that's how you justify it in your mind. That's the crack in the fiction defense. If Davis made everything up to sell books and land documentary deals, the apology is the easiest line in the script. It costs nothing. It makes your story better. Any documentary producer would tell you that the man who confesses and then apologizes to the family gets a bigger audience at the and the richer deal. Davis refused it. He didn't refuse because he's bad at performing. He spent years performing the story across police interviews, documentaries, a BET series, a book, and public appearances. He refused because in that moment, on that tape, he wasn't building a character. He was defending himself against the one question that cuts through every version of the story he's ever told. A man who didn't do anything doesn't defend himself against an apology. He gives one. The jury has now heard 18 witnesses across the first week into the second. They've heard the 2008 proffer recording where Davis described providing the gun. They've heard the 2009 interview where he told the story again to different detectives. They've heard clips in the BET documentary where he said he had cancer and nothing left to lose. And they have heard the 2017 recording from the room where Dorsey was sitting with a phone in his pocket. Davis told the same story across all those formats. The details shift a little bit, the amounts, the specific people he names, the emphasis, but the bones, the account stays the same. The Cadillac, the gun, the nephew in the backseat, Combs in the background. If he was lying, he was lying the same way for nearly a decade to different people in different settings with no script. Same logic runs through the Combs account. A man inventing the story to sell writes the version where the famous person came through and the money landed. Davis told the version where Combs ghosted him, where the calls went unanswered, where the money never arrived. That's not a script designed for a payday. That's a grudge. During cross-examination, Dorsey pushed back at Snaft. He told the defense attorney that his questions were based on conspiracy theories about alternate theories of the case and asked whether the defense had evidence to support them. The judge admonished Dorsey. Witnesses answer questions. They don't ask them. Dorsey may be recalled at any point during the trial. The filmmaker walked into that interview room in 2017 with a phone in his pocket. He walked out as evidence. His recording captured a man who told the story of a killing across every format available to him and couldn't bring himself to say he was sorry for it. I think one of the other questions we have to ask, if we're going to believe that Keefe D is responsible for handing the gun to Orlando that night, the fight, the Cadillac, the handing of the weapon. The other key tenant of that story is Sean Diddy Combs. So if that part of the story is true, is Diddy's involvement true too? That's the question. He's denied it every which way. Was he a convenient out for people? Thinking, well, if we say it was a hit and it was ordered, then we'll get less of a penalty if we ever get caught. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I got to tell you, the alleged involvement of Diddy in this case is reaching a hell of a lot closer to the sun, a lot closer to a potential reality than I thought it was going to. Seems to be a key figure, at least, being alleged to be behind the ordering of this hit. How do you prove it, though? I don't know that you can. I don't know that you can. And so the mystery deepens. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation right there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.